Good afternoon. Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Direct Connect. I'm Leonard Chamberlain, one of the managing partners with Archer. Joined today by a very special guest, a former colleague of mine at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, Mr. Austin Rappaport. Austin is no longer with FERC, so he does not speak for the commission. I'm sorry, Austin, I'm taking your disclaimer for you, but Austin
that's my
is
line.
The head. Yeah, that's your line. Austin is the head of detection engineering and automation for Zurich Insurance's Cyber Fusion Center. So, Austin, tell us a little bit about yourself, please, sir.
Sure. Well, I'll start with that really fun title, which if you acronymize it, it is DEA. And yes, that was on purpose.
Nice.
me and my team are responsible for detection engineering across the entire Zurich insurance corporate environment globally. So Zurich Insurance, if you don't have a business, you probably have never heard of them, but they own Farmers Insurance, and are obviously really big in Europe, where they're headquartered in Zurich, Switzerland. Which, funnily enough, that city was actually named after the company, not the other way around.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
No, I'm joking, but I think they own half of the city at that point. detection engineering, my team builds out all of the alerts and continuous monitoring that Zurich does in its SIM and EDR tools. As well as our NDR tooling. We bring all that together for our incident response and SOC teams to go and investigate when alerts come up.
Very
and
cool.
Then on the automation engineering side, we manage our security orchestration automation response platform, SOAR, and we use XSOAR for that, and really just try to improve the effectiveness of processes across our Cyber Fusion Center, which is a group global spanning, right? We have people in Chicago, in Dublin, Ireland, and in Hong Kong and Australia, managing 24/7 security operations for the global group Zurich environment. Before that, been in this position for about eight and a half years, holy cow. Before that, did a little stint at Commonwealth Edison, which is now, I think, Constellation, or maybe Exelon, they split the local electric utility here in Chicagoland. And then before that, like you said, 4 years at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as an electrical engineer, technically, was my title, but... doing auditing and enforcement of the NERC SIP standards, as well as had a little bit to do with the rulemaking and bureaucratic side of the government, which is actually really interesting.
It is. I always like to sum it up as all the wonderful things the commission does, for those of you that are hearing Austin's name and wondering where you might have seen it, set your DeLorean time circuits to November 22nd, 2013. And that was when FERC Order 791 was officially published, aka the version 5 order, as I like to say, the biggest thing to hit NERC SIP since Order 706. the original order. Austin, you were credited as the primary technical resource on that order. So I'm wondering if you could maybe share some insight and, tell us a little bit about your involvement on the order and, thoughts on that.
I'll throw in the line of I no longer work for the commission, so I definitely don't speak for them. nor any of their staff anymore. And at this point, a lot of my SIP knowledge is probably a little out of date anyways. But that was probably the coolest part of that job was actually, you know, it was not the most technical job in the world, but it was really, really interesting seeing how the sausage is made of federal regulations, right? So, you know, we were involved. I attended quite a few standard drafting team meetings, right, working with NERC and industry partners on developing, kind of writing the standards, both before and after the order. And then worked really closely with our friends in the Office of the General Counsel on the rulemaking itself. And, seeing kind of how the sausage is made, how, that stuff gets put together over a long period of time. And I would say also like the importance of, participation as well, right? I think the rulemaking process is proposed rulemaking, comments, and then the final rule after going through those comments. And that commenting process, I think, is really important. We got a lot of good feedback. You get a lot of stuff from like the trade organizations and things like that that are very canned. But I always liked the more detailed, specific, from people on the front lines, right? And we would get those sometimes too. And they actually had meaningful direction and input into the rulemaking process. So if I'm going to advocate for anything, it's don't just let the trade organizations comment for you. Everyone put in your comments, and they are read and summarized and considered. So
you're here. Well said, sir.
That'll be my pitch for civic duty, I guess.
It's we talk a lot on these episodes about kind of lamenting how drawn out the standards development process is. And, what you're talking about is kind of near the finish line, because you've at the point where there's NOPRs and, official orders approving the standards, you've already been through the initial order, directing NERC to create the standards, and the years that the standard drafting team took to develop the standards and then get them approved through NERC's processes. And then, FERC has its own, process to review, comment on, and approve the standards. And then you've got, another, 12 to 36 months or whatever it ends up being of runway from when FERC approves it to where people have to be auditably compliant. It's just so long.
It's an extremely agile process, right?
Oh, well, yeah. Depends on how you define agile, I suppose. But anyway, thank you for sharing kind of your career path with us. I think it's a very interesting to me to hear someone that's, was a fellow regulator at the federal level that then went into service directly for an investor-owned utility, in the electric sector, for some number of years, and now has actually divorce themselves from all things NERC-SIP and, electric sector. And now you work for, a completely different sector. Along that career path, how have your views on, risk changed and addressing, either cybersecurity risk or compliance risk or just risk in general?
My personal view really hasn't changed a lot, which is, and maybe that's because it doesn't align necessarily with all three of those different organizations, probably until now that I've gotten here at the end, which is where I've stayed the longest, which is probably why, or at least part of the reason why. My view on risk management is, it's a, it's a business decision at the end of the day, but you have to be well informed, and you have to be striving to do the right thing and be striving to push to become more and more secure, right? Because adversaries are just getting better, or at least, you know, more competent, just, you know, along with the defenders. So you have to continuously improve, continuously evolve, if you're going to stay and make it kind of in the game. And I think that's kind of what I tried to advocate and push for, was, you know, improvements at the commission to try to elevate that floor. But we always knew it was kind of a floor and not a ceiling, or at least that's how it should be treated, right? It was the bare minimum. And I think that short stint, and I only spent like 9 months at Commonwealth Edison because I loved it so much. but I think that, you know, that maybe it's the mandatory part of it, or the, you know, regulatory fines are the very granularity in the standards, but it's become the end goal, as opposed to something that just gets accomplished because you're doing the right thing, and you're securing your kind of your organization in general, right? And that's, I think, what is the big difference, right? You can't argue that the insurance sector is not as heavily, if not more heavily, regulated than the electric sector. We don't have things like Lurk and Leap, which actually I don't think exist anymore. But
that doesn't stop some entities from continuing to use those terms, or even inventing completely new terms for their own use. But that's a whole other soapbox for me.
We don't invent in terms as much. In fact, our organization is very, very NIST-based, which, again, another point that I've advocated for during my entire career is, we use the NISC cybersecurity framework and their maturity model to kind of measure ourselves against.
I don't know if you recall, but I worked heavily on that when I was at the commission. So I'm happy to hear that the fruit of my labor is being used.
Yep, exactly. And that's our, like, our primary objective. Our CISO, my boss's boss, his primary objective is to improve our maturity score. So we take it very, very seriously. But we don't live our lives like to adhere to a specific set of standards. I mean, we do incorporate them, and we have to produce evidence for them and whatnot. But we just kind of, do the right thing and do the things that make sense. And the security and compliance kind of follows with that, right? Like, it's, there's a new regulation that no one in the electric sector cares about, but people in Europe are very concerned about, called DORA, which I don't even know what it stands for, but it has, it gets very, very prescriptive.
Is it about exploring?
It's about exploring.
With backpack and wipers and...
It's about exploring for vulnerabilities and simulating bad guys. It's a lot of red team activity in it. Very, very prescriptive around how you're supposed to conduct assessments, both external assessments and internal assessments. We looked at it, and there's a couple of things that we need to tweak and really nail down our documentation on, but we're doing a lot of it already because a lot of these requirements, they're not coming out of nowhere, right? They're baked in, good, solid foundational principles that any cybersecurity practitioner is going to know is, if not a best practice, then a practice that gets you moving in the right direction. So, what I saw at ComEd and what I saw at FERC during audits and stuff is a lot of people treat like NERC-SIP as the kind of the end goal and the I'm compliant, right? I'm fine. It's always meant to be the floor, and you have to take a more holistic view of risk and inform, especially when it comes to a business, right? Inform your stakeholders. But I think once you properly inform people of risk, of the risk that they're accepting by not doing anything, right? Because inaction is a choice. You find that you can get a lot of support to do a lot of good important things by just clearly explaining the risks and explaining the potential impacts.
Yeah, those are excellent points. I think that's something that the electric sector does struggle with, is kind of that executive level buy-in to do more than the minimum. And there's various reasons why that is the case. A lot of it is, budget constraints, most of the people are, already, have full plates or multiple plates of responsibilities, and now they've got compliance on top of that. And, doing the minimum to get by is sometimes all they have time for, all they have budget for. Obviously, those are not acceptable answers to a regulator, right? Oh, we didn't have time. We didn't have enough money. No, that's not going to fly. I think, there's also a degree of, if you do more than the minimum, you may be increasing your security by that approach, but you're also, from a certain point of view, increasing your compliance risk. You're introducing additional requirements into your processes that you're then on the hook for. So that's also a consideration. But I think also, you have the benefit of moving into an industry now that I don't think anyone debates, that bad stuff can happen and what the, potential impacts are. And unfortunately, since we've yet to have that, massive, and not that I'm condoning or hoping it happens, but the electric sector, at least domestically, has not experienced, that level of attack that caused an impact for people to be in the dark. Most people don't recognize how critical that electricity is, because they've never lived in a situation where they haven't had it, where, a tornado or a hurricane or, some other disaster has caused a multi-day, multi-week, multi-month outage. It doesn't take that long for society to break down, and, it's not going to be a fun time when that happens to a large group. We had the Metcalf incident that didn't actually cause a single outage, and we got SIP 14 in response. And, now we're, a year and a half, 2 years removed from some additional substation ballistic attacks that caused some outages. People actually did lose power. So now it's going to be interesting to see, from a regulatory perspective, what the repercussions are in that regard. But your current position, it sounds like an amazing opportunity to have a global view, that you're taking in European standards. You were talking about, Asia, Australia, where y'all have offices, and presumably, other regulations, considerations to take into account. How has that experience, maybe changed your perspective on risk? And I'm thinking in regards to how you address it, maybe through automation or other means.
I will say, just to comment back a little bit on what you said, Zurich did have kind of a watershed moment where they shifted to take security a little more seriously, a lot more seriously. Maybe we benefit from that, right? People didn't lose their lives or lose power or anything like that, but an insurance company is entirely, reputation. Like if you don't have a good reputation, you're not going to last for very long. So, I think that's kind of the motivation on our side, right? Because we compete, in markets, right? It's not, kind of like a lot of the natural monopolies that you see for a good reason, right? In the electric sector, you don't want a million electric wires stringing to your house. I get it. But you know, I think maybe that's kind of, you know, maybe the shift or a little bit of a difference, in that we have a high quality reputation we have to, you know, maintain customers. So how do we deal with risk and same issues, right? We're not insulated from them, right? Risk, you know, lack of budget, lack of, you know, opportunities to grow staff and everything. The only way to deal with it is through automation. I'd say really on both sides of my team, that's what we focus day in and day out on. How do we make sure that the alerts going up to our incident response in SOC are actionable, right? Are actually, you know, something that needs to be investigated. And we, you know, do that by combining different alert sources together and bubbling up the most risky behaviors, right? We do everything behavior based for the most part. But then on the automation of processes and stuff, we try to, we haven't, well, outside of one process, we haven't automated decision making too much, but I think of, like, you know, your standard incident response process as you get your alert, right? You have to do your initial triage and initial analysis, right? So anything we can do to provide context to an analyst, to provide enriched data, right? Like, hey, this process, like Excel spawned PowerShell, right? Give it as much details about what that process did. Give it as much details about, what machine it was on, where that machine is. Is it, a server in a data center housing critical sensitive data, or is it, the contractor's workstation? Different risk for different, different data sensitivities and business criticality, and then give, you know, present all that information to an analyst in easy to digest format, allow them to make a decision, and then, as best you can, automate the response and containment to it too, right? So we have automations to go out and quarantine devices, to go and automatically input firewall blocks, and DNS blocks. We're working on one.
If I can interrupt you there, I mean, that sounds scary when I think about it from the electric sector of having that level of automation potentially with, you know, OT systems that have, you know, command and control capabilities for the grid. It sounds like you're dealing with obviously a different class of assets that don't have that potential level of impact.
We actually automate in checks too, because while we're not, you know, running the electric grid, if we have, you know, a server running our claims application that it needs to be able to respond to a claim in an hour or less, or we get in trouble from a regulator in Europe or you know, something like that, right? So we do have checks in place before we do some of that automation, right, where a human does get involved and has to make a decision. And we've automated that process too, so that it's all documented of, like, hey, this person approved, we went up to this local information security officer as well, or got, you know, the boss's approval before, you know, before we take any of those steps. For someone's workstation, that's gonna, you know, maybe cause them a little bit of headache getting their emails done. We'll do that stuff a little bit more quickly. But not at the same level. We do we automate in those checks too, and automate, which is equally important, the documentation of it. We have everything kind of in, you know, in a case in a timeline order. So that we don't have to, you know, so that if someone asks us for, like, why did you make that decision when you did, we have all of, you know, we can provide them, hey, here's the timeline of events and everything that we took and all the data we analyzed to make that decision, which is helpful during audits too, obviously.
No, that sounds amazing that you're able to automate that. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of our clients, more first-time clients, right, come to us with is not really understanding how they demonstrate they're being compliant with a lot of these performance-based standards. And you know, it's sometimes an education on kind of how you document how you do something. And to have the ability to automate that is probably huge. Yeah, that's very cool. And, you know, we always tell people, you know, when you have the opportunity to do automation, you know, that makes it so much easier from a regulatory perspective. You know, if you have a standard, a requirement, and you have automated versus manual methods to comply, the automated approach is going to get a much quicker pass from a regulator rather than the manual, because the manual one is much more susceptible to the human error angle. That's the one that's going to get the more scrutiny. And invariably, you know, when we're performing mock audits for our clients, where we find issues, not as much so on the automated side. So
you have to document what you're going to do in the automation, which, you know, in our SOAR platform, you get a nice like playbook diagram that you can kind of pop into a Word doc and, you know, with a little expository around it. And I think that's some of the best work we've done to keep auditors off of our back, right? That, you know, if I guess in the purest sense of just doing the right thing, documentation maybe isn't the highest thing on that list, but I do think it's really, really important, because when you write it down, you commit yourself to doing it, it helps you ensure that you do it. And then, yeah, if you can build it into an automated process of when this alert comes in, these are the things we do, and here's the proof for it, it makes those audits a snap at that point. And we do get audited a lot, both internally and externally. And, you know, I'd say the one thing, any ambiguity, write down your interpretation of it, and then just follow it. Right. And at that point, right, you know, yeah, you can argue about the, you know, the definition of, you know, language, different things like that. But as long as you're doing what you say you're going to do, I think that gets you 80-90% of the way there.
Well said. And one of your comments sounds like an amazing potential title for this episode: how to keep auditors off your back. That should generate some hits. But anyway, we're out of time here, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. Austin, thank you so much for making the time to chat with us today. It was great to see you, and really appreciate your insight.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a ton of fun. And if you ever want me to come chat again, just let me know.
Will do. All right. Thank you, sir. And thank you to everyone. We'll see you next time on the next episode of Direct Connect.
Not only is Direct Connect available to listen to, you can also watch each episode on our YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com/@ArcherU. If you're interested in who we are and what we do, you can head on over to our website at archerint.com. You can also follow us on our social media platforms, Archer International on Facebook, Archer Energy Solutions LLC on LinkedIn, and @ArcherSEC on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and check back every other week for brand new episodes of Direct Connect.